Well, good morning. It's a nice sunny day in Wisconsin. My notes tell me that we have students from Central Wisconsin Christian School here. If that's correct, would they please stand? Oh, wonderful. Well, welcome. Please be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar, so they know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us today. If the students can stick around after our next argument, which will conclude around noon, Justice Dan Kelly, right down here, will come down and chat with you all a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court and answer other questions. He won't be talking about the substance of the case that we're going to hear this morning, but there are a lot of things I'm sure you will find interesting. So if you can stay, do, and if you can come back, perhaps that fits in your schedule as well. So for the first case of the day, Miller versus TL 90108 LLC. Counsel, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, ma'am.
Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Brian Fall. I'm attorney from Milwaukee with Crabb, Hubble, and Krawcheck.
Now, before you start, are you just going to make a motion?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, fine. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I am local counsel for the petitioner, TL 90108. I will not be arguing today, but with the court's permission, I would like to introduce Lawrence Heffman from Schiff Hardin in Illinois to argue on behalf of the petitioner.
Very good. Thank you.
Does that mean we're granting him so he can count it as a win?
Oh, yes. Right. Well, welcome to Wisconsin. We look forward to your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Lawrence Heffman, and I represent the petitioner TL 90108 LLC, along with my co-counsel Neil Lloyd and Mr. Fall. The question before this court is, after a six-year statute of repose has run from the conversion, can a subsequent event after that six-year period revive and create a new additional six-year period of repose clock? The answer is no, because the Wisconsin legislature made a policy choice to prescribe a fixed period of time after which those claims and rights are extinguished. Specifically, the Wisconsin legislature chose to 6 years after the wrongful taking or conversion or the wrongful detention begins, the original owner's rights in the vehicle are extinguished. In the words of this court, in the Wanky case, the right and remedy are terminated. As the court said, in Acre, before the cause of action even accrues, the rights have been extinguished.
Why can't there be multiple causes of action against separate actors?
Because to do so would be fundamentally contrary to repose. This is a repose in a replevin context where we...
Why can't the statute of repose apply separately to different actors?
Because in a replevin context, we are settling possessory property rights. It would lead to the absurd result, Your Honor, that let's take this 2001 conversion. 6 years ran. There should be no possible claim against the person who converted the property. But instead, if there's a fortuity of a transfer to somebody else, it theoretically creates a new right at an indeterminate period in the future. And it doesn't matter how long it takes. Let's say that the original converter of the property transferred the property in 50 years. For all that 44-year period, the original owner would have no possible right to the property. Their rights would have been fully extinguished. But under plaintiff's theory, then there's a new right, a new 6-year period. And we keep adding 6-year periods every time the property is transferred. So that would create an entirely unsettled situation as opposed to the fixed certainty that the legislature adopted.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I thought you were done with your answer.
I was just going to say there are certainly many instances, Your Honor, where there are statutes of repose that are keyed off a negligent act. For example, accountants doing an audit. If it's a negligent audit, it's 6 years from their act. But there is on-point authority, and the restatement has specifically addressed the scenario where you have converted property, and then it's subsequently transferred. And Restatement Section 899, which is cited in our brief, addresses this precise scenario. And what it says is, In some cases, the statute of limitation begins to run before the defendant took possession, as when a previous taker converted the chattel and later transferred possession to the defendant. So here, the statute of repose ran 8 years before the LLC purchased the property, 10 years before this lawsuit. And to allow a new statute of repose to arise merely because the property was transferred would lead to a variety of absurd results contrary to repose.
Counsel?
Well, if someone steals your car and then it's recovered, why don't you still own it? It's still your car.
That's the common law rule, and that would certainly be the common law rule. But the legislature interceded here, and they said...
Oh, but the legislature also passed the Uniform Commercial Code, at least Wisconsin's variety, but you don't raise that you're a buyer in the ordinary course. That was not in your materials at all.
We're solely at the stage of a motion to dismiss, Your Honor, on a statute of repose. And so we certainly are a buyer, but that's not the issue here. I mean, we're alleged to have bought the property in mid-2015, according to the complaint. But the issue is, does the plaintiff have any remaining right to this vehicle?
Sure. And this was my question to you.
Yes, Your Honor. And so this Court's opinion in Castellani and its overruling of Freitag addressed this circumstance. What the Court held is Freitag was an intentional theft. It was a stealing of money from an employer by a bookkeeper. And this Court held the discovery rule doesn't apply, and it held that Freitag was wrongly decided. And the Judicial Committee notes, which this Court cited, explain it doesn't matter whether you know you have an injury at all. It doesn't matter if you're aware of the conversion.
You know, you're kind of talking around the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals just interpreted the statute and said that detention of property whose return was demanded is a separate manner of falling under the statute, but it begins when the detention occurs. So they interpreted the statute. What's your best argument that their interpretation is not correct?
I have two best arguments, Your Honor.
Okay.
One is this is a conversion case. The allegation is that the way that the original owner was denied the property was by conversion. Restatement Section 229 says once you have converted property, the receipt of converted property gives rise to a conversion claim.
So then the person who had his or her property stolen comes out on the short end, correct? Because you're saying we can't use the detention part of the statute as the Court of Appeals did. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, because repose cuts off those rights.
Counsel, I
don't think we're communicating, but... Go ahead,
yeah,
Justice Kelly.
I want to just back up in your statement there that if a converter sells property to a new purchaser, that there's still simply a conversion. But I think that runs counter to our case in Eldred, doesn't it? Eldred versus Oconto. It seems that the fact pattern there matches precisely the fact pattern that we have here. Someone took property that he was not entitled to, sold it to a bona fide purchaser for value, and we said that there was a cause of action for wrongful detention against the bona fide purchaser. Yes?
Well, what I think Eldred stands for, Your Honor, that was a case where there was an original taking that was proven to be tortious. And what Eldred said was, if you have a taking, then your detention of the property is unlawful, and it's contrasting a situation where you have a, say, Baylor-Bailey situation where you need to make a demand for return of the property, and you need that demand to be refused to make possession wrongful. And obviously, Eldred wasn't a statute of repose case or a limitation case. And this Court's opinion in Smith v.
So hang on just a second. I don't want to go to statute of repose yet. I want to just start with the cause of action. So Eldred said you can have a cause of action for wrongful detention even when the person against whom it is asserted came into the property by paying value for it without knowledge that it was converted property, correct?
Well, I disagree with that a little, Your Honor. I think what Eldred was saying was, what is the underlying proof that the detention is wrongful? And I don't think it was a general Replevin claim in that case, and they were evaluating whether you had a basis for Replevin.
All right, so just step through this with me then. You agree that the Eldred case dealt with a party who had wrongfully logged someone else's property, correct?
Yes, they received converted property.
No. Step through this with me. Party, let's call him Party B. He goes on Party A's property, takes his trees, logs them. Yes?
Yes, that wasn't the defendant, but yes.
I'm sorry, what?
I don't believe that was the defendant in Eldred, I believe.
No, I know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I just want to line this out so we can line it up against your case, right? So Party B goes on to Party A's property, takes the logs. He had no right to do that, correct? He converted.
Correct.
He converted them.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Party B then sells the logs to Party C, correct?
Correct.
Party C had no idea that the logs were stolen.
Correct.
And we held in Eldred that Party A had a good cause of action against Party C for wrongful detention, correct?
I would not say that. I agree that they said that the detention was unlawful, but it was a Replevin claim generally. And the plaintiff satisfied Replevin in that case by showing that there was a tortious taking and then receipt of that converted property. And so, obviously, that was an earlier case before this iteration of the code. But in that case, the question was, is there a sufficient basis to say you should get the property back? And barring the existence of a statute of repose, plaintiff would have a claim against the LLC for return of converted property, potentially. But here, because the legislature said we are going to prescribe a fixed period 6 years from the conversion, we have cut off those rights.
All right. So let me just follow that up. So your position would require that the alleged thief is able to convey good title to you.
Yes, because the original owner's rights have been fully cut off. And once that person has the property 6 years after repose has run, just like, say, the bookkeeper in the in Castellani overturning Freitag.
Right. Okay, hang on. I just wanted to make sure, I want you to compare your position to what we said in Mergainer versus Fuhrer, where we said it is firmly established in every jurisdiction that a thief cannot obtain title to personal property, neither can he convey title. How does your position line up with that?
That is the common law rule, and if the statute of repose were not present here, it would be true.
And how does statute of repose create something that our common law said could not exist?
Well, the statute of repose terminates and extinguishes the original owner's rights in the property.
Let's say it does. Does that mean that you have title?
Yes, Your Honor.
How did you get title?
We bought it for value, we possess the vehicle, and we have a greater right to that vehicle than any other person.
Except that the thief never had title.
Understood, Your Honor, but once the six-year... I'm sorry, let me interrupt, but...
So if the thief didn't have title, how did you get title?
The thief obtained title 6 years after the statute of repose ran, because...
So your position is that terminating a cause of action creates title.
In the repose context, yes, that is the position that the New Jersey Supreme Court took in O'Keefe. It addressed this precise circumstance where it talked about the receipt of converted property. Both parties cite this case. And in O'Keefe, they said, once the statute runs, it has to vest title. Because otherwise, if the original owner has no right to possess the property at all, never.
So the lesson is, if you're a good thief, make sure you keep the property 6 years before you sell it to anyone.
I understand that policy argument. That is what the legislature chose to do. They chose to cut off 6 years. And that's precisely the effect of the Castellani opinion in Freitag.
Statute of repose in our law says absolutely nothing about title.
It talks about possession. You're right, Your Honor. But the question is, what would it mean if one no longer has any right to possess something, to say that they have title to it? And what the O'Keefe court said is that metaphysical concept that we're going to say, I never have a right to possess this vehicle ever again, but I have title to it, is meaningless.
Finish. I didn't want to interrupt you.
No. What the court said in O'Keefe, Your Honor, is that exactly that. An immortal right to bring an eternally prohibited action is a metaphysical subtlety that the present writer cannot pretend to understand.
As in some past arguments, I want to go from the metaphysical
as I said, to the mundane previously, and I want to do that today. Not that statutes are mundane, but this case is a case of statutory interpretation at the outset. So let's take a look at the statute. The Court of Appeals, in fact, decided this case just based on the statutory, or primarily based on the statutory interpretation, and didn't get to subsequent issues like equitable estoppel, etc. So let's take a look at the words of the statute, and if you can give me your reading of either one of these two statutes, 35 or 51, that is, 893, 35 or 51, how, and show me how your interpretation avoids the criticism that the Court of Appeals had of your interpretation, that you were rendering the word detention surplusage. So help me with that, because that's what, in part, their decision boiled down to.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's actually just the opposite. So what the Court of Appeals did...
Take a look at the language. That's what I want to do. Walk me through it.
Yes, Your Honor. The 893.35
says
the action shall be commenced within 6 years of when the cause of action accrues. The cause of action accrues at the time the wrongful taking or conversion occurs or the wrongful detention begins. So it starts with, what is this case? Is it a conversion case or a wrongful detention case? Our position is it's a conversion case because the vehicle was converted in 2001. The restatement section 229 says it always remains a conversion case when you receive converted property.
Have we adopted that restatement section?
Not specifically, Your Honor, but the court made the same holding in the Smith v. Briggs case where somebody received converted property. They received logs, cut off somebody's land, and the court held that that was a conversion case. So the court has affirmed that same principle. And it's necessary.
I believe that was because the person who received them had reason to believe that they were converted.
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor, but I don't think that the same principle of the restatement should apply here. Because
versus Briggs said. So the defendant Briggs converted the logs to his own use and sold the same to the defendant Henry Sherry, who, well knowing that said timber was so wrongfully taken by Mr. Briggs from said premises. So under those circumstances, it was a conversion by the recipient because he knew it was stolen goods.
Your Honor, I don't think that case turns on that fact, because if the court's view is, or if the legislature's view is, receiving converted property, you're not supposed to receive that converted property, then that's a conversion. And I think that's consistent with that case as well as the restatement, because otherwise we don't have an independent definition of conversion versus wrongful detention. The Court of Appeals defined wrongful detention so generally, it basically said, if you have something, you shouldn't, if you unjustly have something, which would swallow up every conversion case, because the person who took the property in 2001, they have something they shouldn't also. Having something you shouldn't is inherent in a conversion case. It's inherent in a wrongful detention case.
And your argument, as I understand it, that and set forth in paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals, is this. Because the factual allegations in this case do not involve an initial authorized possession that became unlawful because it exceeded the owner's permission, the defendant argues this can only be an action for conversion and cannot be one for wrongful detention. That's the essence of your argument.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's consistent with the historical division between Replevin and Siepen and Replevin and Detinit, which this Court has discussed, and I believe the Olson v. Merrill case long ago. But if the Court of Appeals... I didn't mean to interrupt,
yeah,
Your Honor.
I mean, I was thinking about Bailey, a bailment. And how does that fit into your argument?
That's a classic wrongful detention case, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
So the Court of Appeals in 2671 LLC v. Plymouth cited this Court's opinion in Smith v. Poor Handmaids, where it says, if you give somebody property lawfully and then you demand it back, mm-hmm, at the point you demand it back, their possession becomes wrongful. And that is what triggers a statute of repose in a wrongful detention case. And the Court of Appeals here said, we're going to trigger it based on a demand and refusal. And there are two problems with that. One, there is no demand and refusal in conversion cases. You don't need to demand converted property back. The point is, when you were wrongfully denied the property is when the conversion occurred. And so the clock starts at the time of the conversion.
But your argument assumes that the repose period under the statute must run from the first act of conversion, that there can't be separate acts of conversion or wrongful detention. But the statute doesn't say that.
Well, I think the statute says the wrongful taking or conversion or the wrongful detention.
Well, why can't the wrongful conversion or the wrongful detention simply be referring to the wrongful act of one actor versus another, so that there could be, again, separate repose periods running for each wrongful conduct?
Two reasons, Your Honor. One, I think it is contrary to repose to say we are going to have uncertain and indefinite periods of time. Each act creates new periods of repose. What we're talking about here is not a single audit, a single surgery. We're talking about settling property rights. So if we take the 2001 conversion and we say 6 years after that the time ran, there is no claim against the person who converted the property. And if they kept it forever in perpetuity, this original owner would never have a claim. So that's the effect of this Court's opinion in Castellani overruling Freitag. The only difference...
I just want to pick back up there. You did a neat little move earlier on, and I want to make sure that there's some support for it. So you say that because the statute of repose ran, that the original owner no longer has title, and you assumed from that that the current possessor does. May I propose to you a third possibility and see what you say about this? Let's say that the original owner no longer has any rights in it, but simply by virtue of him losing his rights, doesn't vest them in you. Maybe no one owns it. Right? Tell me why the thief would own it after 6 years. What is it that creates title in him rather than simply no one having title to the property?
Well, I understand the question, Your Honor, and I think repose at least creates a greater possessory right to the vehicle.
Repose creates nothing. All it does is cuts off.
And it creates an affirmative right to be free from a claim.
Okay. Free from the claim, that doesn't give you title. How does the original owner's loss of title create it in you?
Because we purchased the property from
someone who had no title.
Okay. Your Honor.
Let's take you out of the picture. Let's go to the thief, right? So we compare the original owner and the thief and say 6 years runs. What is it that creates title in the thief?
Possession of the vehicle, possession of the actual title to the vehicle, and repose are the things that would create title. But I would submit to you, Your Honor, that this Court doesn't actually need to decide whether the LLC has good title to the vehicle, because we haven't filed a counterclaim, we haven't sought a declaration of that. What this Court needs to decide is, does the original owner still have any rights in the vehicle?
So I think Justice Kelly and I are on the same wavelength, because right when he started asking you, I was about to ask you this. Assume you wait 6 years and then another thief steals it from the first thief. Can the first thief, if he knows who the second thief is, bring a replevin action against the second thief?
Yes, Your Honor. If the 6 years has run, the possessor of the property who is wrongfully denied that possession would then have that claim. That is the result of what the legislature did. Because this is the exact same situation in Freitag, except we're not saying 8 years later the bookkeeper took the cash that she took from her employer and passed it to somebody else. Why would, if that employer was denied the right to get, that was a criminal theft. That was stealing. If that bookkeeper was permitted to keep their employer's cash because it was 6 years after the conversion, why would that employer have a greater right to get that cash back from somebody else years later?
Counsel, the procedural posture here is a motion to dismiss. And the question really, at least the threshold question, is whether or not it should be dismissed because of a statute of repose, right? And so some of these, depending on how this case unfolds, some of the issues of a bona fide purchaser in good faith may or may not be resolved. But right now we're talking about a statute of repose. Both parties agree that these two statutes are each statutes of repose. I want to return to the language of the statute. And your definition, the cause of action, accrues at the time the wrongful taking or conversion occurs or the wrongful detention begins. Your whole argument is that this cannot be a wrongful detention because there is no allegation that the first transfer, if you will, was lawful.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because
where do you find that in the statutes?
Well, I think I find it in the court's case law and the historical distinction between conversion and detention. Because under the Court of Appeals theory, somebody who converts property, you could sue them for wrongful detention. You have an election of remedies. You could sue them for either. And you could sue them when you demand that they don't give you the property back, which would mean it doesn't run from a 2001 conversion. It runs whenever the plaintiff elects to make a demand. And one of the problems with the Court of Appeals opinion is you can't make a demand on somebody if you don't know who has the property, right? And knowledge of who has converted property, knowledge that there has even been an injury, are irrelevant because we are not in a discovery rule world. We are in a repose world where you don't even need to know somebody took your property to have the conversion run. That's what the Judicial Council Committee notes. So what the appellate court did, without explicitly saying it, was require in an instance of converted property that you make a demand for the return of that property first. Now, that's a choice the legislature didn't make here. Other states have that law. This doesn't.
Thank you.
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Okay. You'll have time for rebuttal, too.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. May it please the Court, Matthew Fisher on behalf of Richard Mueller.
Counsel, I want to pick up with the last line of questioning and statement that was made by your opposing counsel. Do you think that the Court of Appeals got it right by having the statute of repose be triggered from the time of the demand? Does that comport with the statutory language that says the cause of action accrues at the time the wrongful detention begins?
Sure. I don't think that demand and refusal is required for the outcome here. I do think.
But was it right?
I think they were just using it as a point to denote a certain time when possession became wrongful, but really it was wrongful from inception. So I do not think that demand and refusal is necessary in order to trigger a wrongful detention claim.
Well, you'd be, if that's your argument, you lose. You lose. Okay, because the Court of Appeals based it on the demand for return of the property and the suit to return the property occurred within the statute of limitations if you separated out detention as an act that could be applied to a separate party. So the first guy was the thief. The second guy, apparently the LLC folks who now have the car, are detaining it.
Correct, but detention, a wrongful detention, doesn't necessitate demand and refusal. They can be detaining it absent that.
When did the wrongful detention begin here?
When they acquired the vehicle.
And what year was that?
2015.
Counsel, why are you arguing that? Why are you arguing that it began,
consistent with the language of the statute, when they acquired it as opposed to the demand?
Because from inception, their possession was wrongful. The thief did not convey them title. The statute of repose did not cut off my clients. And so from inception, when they received the car, it was illawful.
In other words, it doesn't matter, are you arguing, when TL became aware that the detention was wrongful?
That's correct.
Counsel, the statute, I'd like to hear your response to your opposing counsel's argument here that if you're correct and the Court of Appeals is correct, that conversion is completely swallowed by the wrongful detention claim that could be made. And that would seem to not comport with principles of giving effect to every phrase in the statute. How would you respond to that?
I'm not here to argue that there's clear demarcation between conversion and wrongful detention. I think the same conduct could give rise to both claims. In the context of Replevin, it has to be for wrongful detention. Conversion is nowhere mentioned in Chapter 810, the Replevin statute. Conversion is a claim for damages only. So in the context of a Replevin claim, it's a wrongful detention.
So are you saying that are you saying it does swallow that? I mean, again, the example here of a car being converted many years ago, and now it's detained maybe. I mean, is your argument, what's the point of having conversion in the statute whatsoever if you can always make a wrongful detention argument?
Well, you can't make the same claim against the same party. You can't accuse one party of both converting and wrongfully detaining. It's either one or the other. But in the context of a Replevin claim, it's a wrongful detention by necessity. If we were only bringing a conversion claim, we would not be able to seek return of the car.
Well, I understand that, but if detention, if a conversion always becomes a detention at some later point, why does the statute have that language in there? As a matter of making sense of the statute, why not just say wrongful detention? If every conversion is always a detention, a wrongful detention, by the person who owns it or has possession of it at that particular point in time, how are we to make sense of the statute that has other language in there? It provides for a conversion to a wrongful conversion here, and why would it have that language in there if all that's necessary is just a wrongful detention, which is what the Court of Appeals says?
I think what the legislature was trying to do was be all-encompassing in terms of both Replevin and damages, and that's why both conversion and wrongful detention are in the statute, but they're not both in the Replevin statute. It's only a wrongful detention or a wrongful taking. No one's argued that there was a wrongful taking here.
Well, doesn't the Replevin statute have the language conversion? Let me look at it again. At the time of the wrongful taking or conversion. Yeah.
Pardon?
So the Replevin statute has the language of conversion. The cause of action accrues at the time the wrongful taking or conversion occurs, or the wrongful detention begins.
What statute are you looking at?
893.35, the Replevin statute, action to recover personal
property. I'm talking about Chapter 810, the actual chapter governing Replevin actions. Conversion is not in that chapter. If you look at 810.13, which provides the elements of a Replevin claim, it only lists two particular types of acts, wrongful taking or conversion. Or wrongful detention.
I want to follow up on a prior question from Justice Hagedorn, who asked, you know, every conversion is a wrongful detention. Let me put a question mark on that. Is every conversion also a wrongful detention?
No, I don't think so. I think that wrongful detention is actually a broader concept than conversion. But again, in the context of a Replevin claim, it doesn't say conversion, just wrongful detention. So I think that the same conduct could be a conversion or wrongful detention in some cases, but not in the context of a Replevin claim.
Let me ask, just to test you a little further, you've responded to the question of, is every conversion also a wrongful detention? Let me ask, is every wrongful detention also a conversion under your argument?
No, I don't think so. Again, I think there are factual situations that where you would be broader than a conversion but could be a wrongful detention.
I'm just pulled, so I haven't studied. The jury instruction and the note that deals with a conversion, and I'm referring to the jury instruction note in jury instruction 220. And it cites a case, Donovan versus Barkhausen, for this premise. It says, types of conversions. Acts of conversions are ordinarily classified as, number one, a taking from the owner without his consent. Number two, an unwarranted assumption of ownership. Three, an illegal use or abuse of the property. And four, a wrongful detention after demand. Have you, and then cites this Donovan case, have you had the opportunity to look at that Donovan case?
I have not. Okay. But I know the...
Pardon?
I know the jury instruction.
Yes, and so the jury instruction, the notes on the jury instruction seem to suggest that a wrongful detention after demand is a type of conversion. I'm not saying the jury instruction is the law, because we've said jury instructions are not
right.
The law. But I'm saying I'm reading to you what it says, and how do you respond to that?
Well, I think we're missing the point a little bit, because it's really not whether this was a wrongful detention or a conversion. Again, I think it has to be considered a wrongful detention. The real point of the Court of Appeals decision and what we're arguing here today is one party can convert and another party can wrongfully detain. Similarly, one party can convert and another party can convert, and you can have successive conversions, and you would have a cause of action against each one of them.
You seemed to suggest earlier that you could not have a cause of action for both conversion and wrongful detention against the same party. Why not? I mean, why you see alternative pleading all the time?
The single cause of action rule. That'd be claim splitting. And even if you did, it wouldn't matter, because the statute would run from the same point. If you're trying to say that the same conduct is both a wrongful detention and a conversion, the statute runs at the same point.
Counsel, if I understand your argument, so if it's 2022, regardless of whether any demand was made or not, you would say that your client would have no ability to bring a claim under this statute of repose. Is that correct? Assuming the same party retained has the vehicle.
Against who?
The party that has the vehicle right now.
Probably not.
Probably, or I'm
probably not. No, probably not. Unless there was an equitable defense or something. That if TL had held the property for 6 years, I think that they would be entitled to the defense of repose. I still don't think that would necessarily have settled title. That's a separate issue.
So your argument that wrongful detention in this situation, right? And putting title aside for a minute, your argument would be that as soon as they purchased the vehicle, whether they knew it was, wrong or not, whether they knew that there were some problems or it may have been stolen or not, assume they did it in good faith. Your argument would be that the statute of repose still has effect, that the fact that they have something that they should not have, even though they don't know they shouldn't have it, that is how wrongful detention would work in the context of the statute in this case.
Correct.
What's wrongful about that if they thought they had it?
Because they don't have a right to be holding the property. So it's wrongful from its inception, whether they know that or not.
Intent is not an element, then.
That's correct. Intent is not an element.
So if your client were suing much later, or they had acquired the property earlier, so it wasn't within a 6-year window from either when they obtained the property or when the demand for the property was returned, you might not get it back, but I still don't understand where the title goes. It seems to me when someone steals your car, you still own it. So the thief may have it, you may cut off a claim against the thief, but I don't quite get how that fits with somebody's got to have title to the property, and I don't see the statute conferring that. You want to address that a little bit?
Yes. You're talking about the issue of adverse possession. And so Wisconsin law follows the common law that we treat thieves differently. It's the same under the UCC. A thief, it's a question, I think it's an open question under Wisconsin law whether a thief can ever, under any circumstance, acquire good title. But in this case, there are specific reasons why the thief could not have divested us of title, as counsel says. And that's because the mere running of the statute of repose, which our position is that it has not run against the thief, that doesn't divest us of title.
Right.
It may just eliminate a particular remedy. We still have another remedy to get the car back, criminal restitution. And so under their theory, the thief that steals, conceals your property for 6 years, comes back to Wisconsin and is arrested, gets to keep the property and go to jail. That's not the case. We have not been divested of our title. Now, if an innocent purchaser held the property for 6 years, I think there's a better argument there that you may
get to the ordinary course that
you may divest the rightful owner of their property. But I think that that's a bigger issue, adverse possession of personal property, and I think it needs some consideration. Are we going to require more than just the running of the repose period in order to adversely possess someone's property? In the context of cars, probably. We probably should have open and notorious possession. Why? Because we require people to go get titles so that this issue doesn't arise. They bought a $7 million car without checking the title.
As I understand it, your claim under 893.51 is a declaratory judgment claim for declaring ownership, right?
We're seeking, yes, it's not under 893.51, it's under the Declaratory Judgment Act, but yes, we're seeking a declaration as to ownership,
yes,
not just as to them, as to everyone.
Counsel, your position on wrongful detention does seem to at least run counter to, again, the restatement, which was mentioned earlier, that the general rule seems to be that it accrues when initially converted or when initially wrongfully detained, even if an innocent party later receives it. Whether they were innocent or not, you know, I guess that remains to be seen. I'm not sure what the scoop is in this particular case, but it seems that your position is different than the restatement in the way this is ordinarily decided around the country. Do you agree with that or do you disagree with that?
I agree that we disagree with the restatement. I also disagree how you characterize this as the general rule. The general rule at common law was that if your property was stolen, you could never be divested of title, no matter how many times it was transferred, and each subsequent transfer was a separate act of conversion, which would trigger a new clock. That is the common law rule. That is Muir. Now, what has Wisconsin done with these statutes of repose? Have we somehow, as counsel suggests, changed the common law rule? Well, maybe. I think that's for a future case, because in this case, for the very reasons I told you, we could not have been divested of title by the thief. So it's different because there's a thief involved here and they purchased from the thief.
Can you explain exactly what it is precisely that you disagree with about the restatement and how you would state the rule?
I think what I disagree about with the restatement is that when there are successive conversions, which very clearly under Wisconsin law trigger separate causes of action, you run the limitations period on the first one in the series. That restatement has not been cited, to my knowledge, in a single case, ever. Let me address a few other things.
What kind of mischief is there with the requirement that it be upon demand be an element? Am I making myself clear? The Court of Appeals
sure
does that, and you know, sounds reasonable to me. Maybe this Donovan case or whatever the case was that I cited. Yes, Donovan says that. The comments say it says that. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But what's wrong with it? Boy, you're running away from it.
Demand and refusal is a sensible rule. That is the rule in New York. That's the rule in New York. The issue with it, as counsel is going to bring up, is that in some ways that reintroduces the discovery rule, because you can't make demand on someone until you know who they are. And the statute is a statute of repose, and the discovery rule is not applicable to statutes of repose.
The wrongful detention piece, I just want to go back to something that was brought up earlier. This is a tort functionally, right? So usually there's some measure of has to be wrong. And you're saying the wrongful part is simply that you own or that you now have purchased a vehicle that that was taken at some point in time, right? Or that you have wrongfully in some way. I guess what I'm trying to get at here is why this starts at the time that they purchased it. And how much does their knowledge that this may have been stolen at one point in time matter to the claim? Does it matter if they're an innocent purchaser and they have it or not? You seem to suggest there that it did matter if they were an innocent purchaser of the vehicle. I guess I'm trying to sort through their culpability and whether that matters at all under a wrongful detention claim.
Kind of a compound question there, but let me try to pick apart that question.
You can object.
Pardon me? No, you can't.
I can't.
Okay. Do I think that their knowledge of it matters? No. If they knew that the car was stolen when they acquired it, they would not only be subject to civil penalties, they'd be subject to criminal penalties. They would have purchased stolen property. So I hope their position is that they didn't know about it. But that doesn't, under the statute, I don't think that their knowledge of it matters. The clock would still start and run on them, even if they didn't know.
So an innocent purchaser who purchases something that might have been converted many years before does not have a defense under the statute of repose. That's your position?
Not just they have the defense of repose. They don't have an innocent defense. There's no innocent defense, good faith purchaser exception. That's not a defense to purchasing stolen property. Not a defense under Wisconsin law or the UCC.
Now, they'd have to prove they were a buyer in the ordinary course, which has very definite parameters.
Correct. But keep in mind, even under the UCC, when we're talking about stolen property, they're not conveying voidable title that they can somehow make better. It's void title. They get nothing. And that's what they got in this case. And that's why when they acquired the property in 2015, it was wrongful under Wisconsin law. It doesn't matter if the statute of repose had run on the thief. We still own the property. So when they conveyed it to them, their acquisition and maintenance was wrongful.
The purpose of your declaratory judgment action, is it just to get to the criminal restitution piece, or are there purposes beyond that? And trying to understand how that relates to this.
Sure. Well, first thing is the DMV has requested a declaratory judgment as to who owns this car. So we want to get title. And we want to clear title not just vis-a-vis TL, but the world at large. We own the car. We want a title. The other reason that we're seeking a declaratory judgment is I'm not sure we don't have other remedies available to us, like a 968.20 petition action, to get the vehicle back. And we certainly don't want title declared in their favor. And we can get a declaratory judgment, whether that be in a positive or a negative nature. Let me address a few other points. Castellani has nothing to do with this case. We are not arguing the discovery rule, and this case comes out the same whether or not these are statutes of limitations or statutes of repose. If Castellani tells us anything, it tells us that you run the time from the defendant's wrongful act. Smith v. Briggs. Smith v. Briggs was a joint conversion. They acted in concert. That's why it was considered one conversion. That's not their position, and that's not our position. They weren't acting in concert. These were individual, separate in time, separate in actor, separate in manner conversions, or a conversion followed by a wrongful detention. Let me return to the statutory language, because that's what this is. Anyways, this is a case of statutory interpretation. The use of the definite article the in front of wrongful detention, in front of cause of action, in front of wrongful taking, denotes that all it's talking about is a particular cause of action based on a particular act. The textual link between cause of action and the act tells us whose act we're talking about. It's the defendant's act. Why? Because it's only the defendant's act that can give rise to a cause of action against the defendant. So the notion that we're talking about running this clock from some third party's act is contrary to the statutory language. It's also contrary to how Wisconsin defines cause of action. Under the Boyd v. Aetna case, it's very clear. A cause of action is defined by the defendant's wrongful act, and separate wrongful acts by different defendants give rise to separate causes of action. Finally, again, if there was any question about whose act the statute is referring to, we can go back to the substantive claim at issue. That's a Raplevin claim here. And what does 810.13 tell us whose act we're talking about? It's the defendant's. So it's clear as day who the statute is referring to. Unless the court has any further questions, I'm prepared to cede my time to my co-plaintiff.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Joseph Ford. I am a plaintiff in this action, simply trying to get back a stolen car. A couple of points I'm going to add to what Matthew said is, I do agree with the Court of Appeals, but I thought there might have been an easier way to reach their decision, and that is by taking a look at 893.19 subsection 1. And that's where basically it says, if a actor flees the state and you can't serve him, then the statute tolls. So my response to TL's position is that as to the first defendant actor, if he ever possessed, that statute would have been tolled by definition, by the operation of that statute. And there's an additional way out, and that's 893.93 subsection 1B, and that gives grounds for relief from fraud. In other words, if fraud is involved in the cause of action you're pursuing, that particular statute then reimposes the discovery rule such that we'll run the clock from the time you discovered the fraud. And my position would be, in the case of the thief who flees and hides his identity and hides his property, it's just right in the statute. The legislature gave us a tool. He's committing a fraud. We're not going to give him the benefit of running out the clock. We're not going to let him game the system. We're going to say, okay, we're going to say once you discover the fraud, you come back to us in your cause of action. So I think there are two off-ramps to this dispute that will help reimpose common sense. You know, everyone I talk to about this case, they go, that can't be right. There can't be right. A thief can hide, and then he gets title, and he's good to go. It just can't be right. And that has been the approach that I said, if you don't see it in that statute, look around to the other statutes, because the legislature has a lot of tools for us, and they have provided the key tool that I think is 893.19 subsection 1 to get, if the defendant were possessing, I still argue that 893.35 is aimed at the possessor. If you don't possess property, you're not a defendant for 893.35. And And I've been struggling with an issue, and maybe you guys can address this. 939.10, and that statute abolishes all common law crimes such that it seemed to take away what might have been in common law both a crime and a tort. That statute seems to say, okay, now that we got codified crime statutes, we're going to take away all the conduct that's criminal, go over here, and all that remains in the common law side or the civil statute would be the torts. And I maintain that theft is not a tort. Theft is more of a crime. The legislature seemed to give us a different hopper for dealing with that conduct. And then they even gave us civil causes of action for victims of crime. So it sort of supports that you go one way or the other and you have remedies if it's a tort. I don't believe they knowingly took the car knowing it was still stolen. I believe their conduct is just a wrongful detention, and once we brought it to their attention, my belief is the clock starts when we made demand, because otherwise they were sort of just possessing wrongly, but not knowingly wrongly. So I want to make clear that it's, for me, the clock would start then.
You see it a little bit different than...
I take a common sense. I used to be a licensed car dealer in two states, and I'm very familiar with title statutes and the reciprocity among all the states. And I do think, too, that this is a special group of special circumstance of property. When it comes to vehicles, there are specific protocols in every state. How do you transfer and acquire title? And I can demonstrate they broke five Illinois laws in their acquisition because they took shortcuts. They didn't do some homework. And I believe that will protect us, too, once we get downstream and get past this dismiss motion. So I think that's the main points I wanted to bring.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, as you get set up, I'm wondering if you would respond to something that Mr. Ford brought up. The individual who stole the car was actively concealing the fact that he stole the car and presumably waiting upon or banking on his ability to continue doing that so he could take advantage of the statute of repose. Do we honor such fraudulent behavior with the operation of the statute of repose under these circumstances?
Yes, because the legislature makes a choice of whether to include an exception for fraud or concealment in its statutes of repose.
Well, we call it equitable estoppel for a reason, right? It's because it's not in the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I'm speaking specifically of the accountant statute discussed in the Feldman v. Ferris case, the health care provider statute discussed in the Landis case. The legislature has specifically included exceptions when the actor commits fraud or concealment in the performance of an audit, in the performance of a surgery. So the legislature...
So your position is the legislature affirmatively decided that it would reward thieves for effectively concealing their fraud by awarding them title after 6 years.
I didn't mean to interrupt, Your Honor. By adopting repose, the legislature adopted 6 years for conversion. Conversion includes criminal thefts. This court held that it was wrong to find the claim timely against the bookkeeper who stole. So we need to give effect, unless the court is going to overrule the Castellani case and its treatment of Freitag, that is a case involving a criminal theft where a bookkeeper stole money and kept the fact that she stole the money confidential long enough for there to be an untimely suit against her.
Well, Castellani was a little bit different. That dealt with the statute of limitations and whether the discovery rule would apply. And the discovery rule operates against the accrual of the cause of action, right? So we said that, look, if we imported the discovery rule into a statute of repose, that would erase the distinction between statutes of repose and statutes of limitation. Equitable estoppel does not operate against the accrual of the cause of action. It operates against something else. What is the distinction against which equitable estoppel runs if it's not the accrual of the cause of action?
Well, equitable estoppel is focused on, has somebody convinced you that you haven't been injured? And the cases that are cited here, well, most of them deal with statute of limitations, but they are a person acts like a husband and a father, the Sesednik case, for the period of time until they can no longer establish paternity, and then he leaves his responsibilities. So nobody convinced the plaintiffs here that they didn't have their car stolen. Obviously, they filed a police report and believed they were injured. So there's no false sense of security here, which is what equitable estoppel is. But this Court, they rely on Johnson v. Masters to argue equitable estoppel. But Justice Ziegler's concurrence in that case, joined by the Chief Justice, said, we are not recognizing a general equitable exception to statutes of repose, because to do so would substitute our own equities and assessment of the situation for the legislature's.
Well, Johnson versus Masters suggests that there is an impossibility element, right?
Legal impossibility, not factual impossibility. Because here, the Judicial Committee has very clearly said, it doesn't matter whether you know you have been injured for the conversion statute to run.
That's the discovery principle, though. This goes to the question of impossibility. Can you pursue the cause of action? And in Johnson versus Masters, you couldn't pursue the cause of action because of a statutory impediment. Here they couldn't pursue the cause of action because of a successful theft and a continuing concealment of that fraudulent behavior. What's the difference?
Well, I think the difference, Your Honor, is if one were to adopt a rule that said any instance of fraud or concealment means we will toll a statute of repose, you are creating the uncertainty that by choosing a statute of repose, the legislature did not want. The legislature, like New York or New Jersey you heard about, they adopted the most possibly protective rules. They either adopt the discovery rule or they adopt the rule that says, even if I know who has my converted property, I could wait 50 years, and then once I make a demand on them, that starts the clock. That is not what the Wisconsin legislature did. They chose to cut off rights 6 years from the conversion or detention. And as this Court has said, we need to give effect to each term. We need to separate out conversion and wrongful detention.
Counsel, if your motion to dismiss were granted, who has title?
Your Honor, our position would be that we have title, but I actually don't think you need to resolve that question in order to grant the motion to dismiss, because we know the original owners of this property don't have any further interest in the property. And I raise the issue of what does it mean for repose
to... Well, the original owner is deceased, but he did leave title to someone...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I mean his successors in interest. I should have clarified that. So anybody who's taking through the original owner has no right to possess the property, just like the employer had no right to the cash back.
I wasn't talking about possession. That's the claim that Rip Levin, but I was asking you what your position was on title. And that's fine. You may be right. Maybe we don't need to get to that at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, we are going to take a brief recess so that... the next case can get set up, and we will be back in a few minutes. We are adjourned.